Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I'm Tom Bassett, professor of geography here at the University of Illinois. I'm sitting in for David Inge, who is away on vacation. Our guest this morning during the first hour is Dr. Don Mitchell. Don is distinguished professor of geography at Syracuse University. He is also the chair of the Department of Geography and the director of the People's Geography Project. Don is on campus to give a public lecture this evening at 7 p.m. in Plym Auditorium in Buell Hall. The title of his talk will be Battlefields, Braceros, Agribusiness, and the Violent Transformation of the California Agricultural Landscape During World War II. Don has authored a number of books. The most recent is titled The Right to the City, Social Justice and the Fight for Public Spaces, published by Guilford Press. I thought, however, that I might steer the conversation, at least initially, towards a discussion of your first book, Don, since the topic of tonight's lecture picks up where you left off in that book. The title of this first book is The Lie of the Land, Migrant Workers and the California Landscape. Before we begin the discussion, I just want to say to our listeners that the lines are open. I'd like to open up the discussion to include the listening audience. And if you have any questions that you would like to ask our guest or comments related to our discussion, you can call the local number being 333-9455 or toll free 1-800-222-9455. Our only request is that you keep your question or comment short so that we can allow as many callers as possible to participate in the conversation. So, Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
In your book, The Lie of the Land, you write about the representation of that landscape in California and popular culture as a landscape of beauty and abundance, in which people like farm workers are omitted from the canvas, from photographs, from the prose. There's been a lot of it. But you write, it is people who, through their labor, produce that landscape, so that their history and struggles with landowners must form part of the big picture. In essence, the book is about the interpretation of landscape. Can you tell us how geographers are typically interpreted by geographers and others like art historians, and how your book offers an alternative way of reading landscapes?
I'll see what I can do anyway. Landscape is an incredibly complex idea, but for most of us, when we hear the term, it conjures up a picture of the land out there, the view from a hill, the view across a plain, the view down a city street, perhaps. It also conjures up a way of picturing that on canvas, as you suggested, or in a photograph, a way of representing the world outside. And one of the arguments that geographers have long made is that we can read landscapes. We can look at them. We can dig into them. We can try and understand how it is that they came about. And by doing that, understand something about the people who made them, what their interests were, how their cultures operated, why they engaged in the kinds of activities that they did. I think that's a very, very important way of thinking about the landscape. But I think it's also a very problematic way, because when we're simply looking at a view, we often don't ask the questions of what we don't see, what's not right there in the representation, what don't we picture. And I think it's important to dig behind the view and try and understand who it is that maybe created that landscape, who's written out of that landscape or not pictured in it, who gets pushed aside and under what conditions and why. And so what I tried to do in The Lie of the Land was make an argument about how we have to understand those pictures as being very important, those views as being very important, as the beautiful as being very important, but at the same time understand how they came to be, what sort of function seeing things in an aesthetic way like that has in making some people's lives invisible and why, and then what it matters for the way that we live our lives, make our livings, get our food, since we're talking about agricultural landscape, and engage with other people across space.
So why is this alternative interpretation or reading important?
I think it's important for a number of reasons. One is to help bring out what the lives and interests and activities of those people who are hidden in the landscape might be. And I think that's a crucial aspect. It's not something that I do a lot of, however. My own work tries to understand the landscape as a built form as well as a picture, a place that we live in and live through, a place that is important in the way that we organize our economics, the way we organize our social lives, the way that we live together with each other. And so understanding who's not pictured in that landscape, who's written out of it, who doesn't belong in it in the built form, is a political move. It's a political move that tries to bring to the surface the lives and the interests and the importance of those who are made to disappear. And by politically bringing them to the fore, we can then raise questions about what is just in our society and what is unjust in our society and why. We can also raise questions about how our economies work. How is it that food is grown? And under what conditions? And California is a very, very important and interesting place to look at this because it is such an important agricultural state, of course. It's not the only one, but it's an important one. And it's a very specific kind of agriculture that goes on there, highly market-based around specialty crops for the most part, which are most dominant now. It is the one that provides most of the fruit and vegetables across the United States for most of the year. And in that way, the way the landscape operates economically as well as politically is crucial because there has to be places for all those people who do the work, those who build the landscape, harvest the landscape, move through the landscape, and yet they're at the same time often written out of or made invisible in the landscape. And so understanding where our food comes from, how those economies work, what it means for us in our everyday lives, as well as for those who are living in them, I think is a crucial question.
Those are important questions, yes. You note that, and I'm quoting here, the more the word landscape is used, the greater its ambiguity. And the greater its ambiguity, the better it functions to naturalize power. What do you mean when you say that landscapes naturalize power?
The landscapes that we live in are often, for most of us, a lot of the time, things that we just simply take for granted. We don't think a lot about them. We don't think very much about the world that we're moving through when we drive from our home to the supermarket, or when we go off on vacation, or even when we're watching on the news and we see a natural disaster and what's going on. We might think about the people leaving those. We might think about the destruction that happens. But we don't think a lot about where that landscape came from, why it looks the way it does, why it was built in the form that it did. And how it operates, how it separates different classes from each other, how it functions to create differences in race, right, which get reproduced, remade in the landscape itself by creating hard and fast lines sometimes between peoples. We don't think too much about that in our everyday lives. It's very natural not to think too much about that, in part because if we're thinking about it all the time, it would be an utterly depressing world, and most of us don't want to live in that world and can't live in that world. So landscapes become naturalized in the sense that we take them for granted. We're constantly taking them for granted. And the concept of landscape is actually instrumental in that process. Landscape is a view. That's how we often think about it. Or landscape is the built form. It's just the world that's out there. To the degree that it shows that this is what's natural, this is what's right, this is the way we ought to see things, it naturalizes those power relations that made this landscape. So let me give you a very brief example, which I think might help clarify it, away from California, but in a different world. And this comes from a person by the name of David Van Arsdale, to cite my sources, who was a graduate student at Syracuse University a while ago. And he was interested in day laborers in Syracuse and the work that day laborers did. And one of the people that he interviewed was someone who was actually a fairly skilled mason. But he had been on a number of hard times. There had been all kinds of problems with him. But also the way labor markets had changed. People who were bricklayers ended up working in day labor markets. He got hired to do the facing on the one of the stores in our mall. And I'm forgetting which store it was, but it's one of the big home kind of stores. And he this person who was hired to do that was hired to do a day's work to put the stone facing on the front of this store. And he went and took Dave Van Arsdale back to look at this, to show him his handiwork. They both got kicked out of the mall because, of course, that work wasn't his, the masons. That work was the designers. That work was the store owners. That work was the mall managers. That work was something for the patrons to enjoy, not for the scruffy-looking guy and a long-haired graduate student, which he was at the time, to be standing around talking about with a tape recorder in their hand. Mm-hmm. So this work that this person did was completely naturalized. It just is. It belongs to the designer or the store managers or the store owners or the customers, not to the person who made the work. He himself was pushed out and made invisible. That's a very small story that talks about a larger-scale process, the way that we create these things and then forget how they get made.
I'd like to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Don Mitchell, professor of geography at Syracuse University. He's here on campus. He is going to give a public lecture this evening at 7 p.m. in Buell Hall on his research on agricultural labor in the California landscape. Also like to open up the discussion to include our listening audience. If you have any questions that you would like to ask our guests or comments related to our discussion, you can call 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. The title of your book, The Lie of the Land, is evocative. What do you mean by the lie of the land?
I mean that the land lies to us, and it does, because there's a great line from Kerry McWilliams, kind of a great investigator of California in the middle of the 20th century, eventually the editor of the Nation, and he talked about how when you drive through California, he's writing about the 1930s, when you drive through California, you can drive up and down the state without ever realizing that there's an army of some 200 or 250,000 migratory workers trooping up and down, harvesting the crops, planting the crops, weeding, spraying pesticides, and so forth. But as soon as you know that they're there, it's all you can ever see again. You start finding their camps. You start seeing evidences of them in roadside rest areas. You see them in ditch bank settlements and so on and so forth. But the land itself doesn't give up that information easy. It's very easy to drive up and down now Interstate 5 or Highway 99 and not pay any attention to the fact that there are hundreds of thousands, and now up to about 700,000 workers moving through the California landscape at any time. They get hidden in the landscape. So it's a lie in that sense. It's a lie in another sense, too, also, which I try and develop in the book, which is that there's a whole ideology about California as being, in many ways, kind of the end point of the American dream. And California is where many people went precisely because a new kind of life was possible. A new kind of life lived in bungalows and small quarter-acre lots with maybe a couple of orange trees. It's really the California dream, the real beauty of California in that regard. And that's what I grew up in, and it's absolutely true at one level. At the other level, the very thing that makes that life possible is an incredibly unjust system of agricultural labor. An incredibly unjust system that requires now for the majority of people picking in California to be paid below a minimum wage, and many, perhaps as many as half, to be paid below, in the first instance, below a living wage, in the second instance, below a minimum wage. And so the land tends to hide some of those facts until we dig them out and understand them. And so it's that kind of issue that I'm trying to raise.
You quote at one point Marxist geographer David Harvey, who asserts that the development of capitalism and the reproduction of labor power, quote, requires the creation of very specific geographies. Can you tell us what geographies agrarian capitalism in California required during the first half of the 20th century?
Yeah, there's a whole range of geographies, I suppose, that it required. It required a land amassing. In some instances, for some crops, the creation of incredibly, incredibly large land holdings. By the end of the 19th century, some of them as large as 200,000 acres. And it required that, I'm not sure required is the right term, but it encouraged those as a means of engaging in economies of scale, of course, but also because, at least the argument went, since markets were so distant, minimizing the cost of small holdings and so on and so forth, and creating large holdings, created economies of scale that allowed for the sale of wheat, for example, in the 1880s, 1890s, in distant markets in the East or in Europe primarily. It required the creation of small holdings in some place and very, very intensive growing in California, around things like fruit crops, for example, or lettuce and so forth. Small holdings in part to break up the risk, but in part also because the intensity of it was so great. But all of these required large armies of very temporary labor. In the big wheat fields in the 1890s, for about 2 weeks, labor was needed when the wheat ripened. In the orange groves of the 1920s, it might be a season of 6 to 8 months. In the lettuce in the Imperial Valley in May, it might be a season of 6 weeks. And at that time, somewhere between 600 and 800% of the labor that is needed at the low time was needed. So there might be 30,000 workers needed at harvest time in a particular region, but perhaps only 3,000 or 4,000 workers needed at planting time, which is kind of the second peak. And in between, there might even be fewer that are needed. And so geographies had to be created that allowed these workers to appear in time for the harvest and then disappear. Because if workers who aren't working are around, they're incredibly expensive. They require food, they require lodging, they require medical care and all of that. So California began to develop as a particularly unique agricultural landscape, one in which there was an incredible monotony of crops, monocropping within regions, but an incredible diversity across regions, which allowed for this migratory stream up and down the state, and in fact into Oregon and Washington, where workers are moving up and down the street at a quite rapid pace, actually, and a lot of them, but also in an incredibly unorganized way. And that bad organization came out in the forms of labor camps, which are scattered all over the place, came out in the form of labor surpluses appearing all of a sudden in one place when they weren't necessary. But that in many ways was in fact quite functional to capitalist farmers because it drove down wages. And they argued that was important because of transportation costs and so forth. But it also meant that it just drove down wages.
So the distribution of the population is one of these important geographies. Your book makes an interesting and important argument that to control labor, California farmers found it necessary to control the spaces in which migrant farmers lived, moved, and protested in. Can you expand on this very geographical argument that links the social relations of production with spatial relations?
Sure, and maybe I can do it best through an example.
Great.
And that's from, if I'm remembering correctly, 1934 in early spring in Alameda, so just south of Oakland, California, where, in fact, Earl Warren, later governor and Supreme Court justice, was the district attorney at the time. This was a time of incredible labor militancy in California. There was a huge wave of strikes across California in 1933 and 1934. And growers were scared. They were scared about the transformations. Many of the workers were organizing through communist unions. Not all of them, the AFL and the CIO, were involved as well. But there was a lot of labor militancy. Growers were scared. The state was scared. State agents were scared. Police were often responding quite violently. What Earl Warren wanted to do was dampen down the violence, and he's very clear about that, but also protect the interests of the pea growers, largely in southern Alameda County. His argument was that if labor camps were moved off of the main highways and into the middle of farms, where they could only be reached, so therefore more onto private property, and could only be reached by a road through the farm, then wildcat strikes would be less possible, right? By moving the camps, by hiding the camps further into the farms, wildcat strikes would be less possible. The kind of violence that was developing around wildcat strikes would be lessened, right? So it's a clear geographical strategy. Now, in my telling of this, of course, it's a geographical strategy that's meant to depower workers, and I think that's exactly what it did. In Earl Warren's telling of it, of course, it's a way to dampen down the violence that was between capital and labor and in which his own sheriffs were getting involved. And we could interpret that, I suppose, either way. I think that the effect did, in fact, drive down it did decrease violence in some ways on picket lines, but it also made it a lot harder for workers to organize. This became known as the Alameda Plan and became replicated across California as ways of organizing where now laborers would live. They'd live more fully on growers' property, mm-hmm. where the rights of union organizers were far less because of the way that property laws operated, and for the very fact that the growers were further hidden in the landscape. So that's one way in which kind of social relations and spatial relations come together. This movement of camps, this Alameda Plan, transformed the social relations of capital and labor within the California landscape. And it was quite directed. It was on purpose. But it transformed how organizing happened in the future. It transformed the power that labor's had and so forth.
Is there a difference? You talk about the production of landscape in your book, and also you talk about the production of space. And are you talking about the same process?
This is a question that confuses me too, and it confuses my students no end. I'm teaching a seminar on landscape right now, and we keep going back and forth about this. And if we threw in the term place, it would get even worse. Because there's an argument that the landscape idea, right, and this is the way of seeing the world as a landscape, as a view, as a place out there, as something outside of us, has a particular history. It's a history that that actually derives from Venice in the 1500s, when perspective as a way of seeing was being developed, but also from Flanders around the same time when new kinds of landholdings were being developed, new kind of merchant classes were arising, and new ways of organizing the land were being developed. So this landscape way of seeing has a history as a view from which the viewer is separated. It's what we see beyond us, outside of us. And so in that sense, the idea of landscape has a very specific meaning. I try and broaden it a bit to talk about landscape as form, landscape as a built place, in that kind of more general sense of landscape. And then it starts shading into the question of space. In some ways, a landscape is like a space. It's just an area. And there's a long tradition of thinking about landscape as area or region as well. I think it's important to think about those two different meanings and how they interact, the way we try and construct our spaces after that ideal of landscape, a particular kind of view, but also the way we try and reconstruct it as a space that we live in. I think space is a slightly more general term in the way that I've just been using it. Part of that argument is that landscape is always an outsider's way of seeing. Landscape is something that we're always outside of. And then the question becomes, who's inside it? What is a landscape for someone who lives in that place? And I just used the term place there. And it was on purpose, I think, because place suggests this notion of being inside, being part of it. The value of the term landscape, right, is precisely that complexity. It raises the question of the view, of being outside, being able to control the view, being able to control what places look like, right? But it also then raises questions of how then, if it's a view, if it's something outside, can people live within it? How can they transform it into a place? How can they remake that landscape as something like a place that is theirs? Because landscape's alienating in that sense that it's outsiders. So I think that's where some of the distinctions are. It's a very fine line, I suppose, and maybe a quite theoretical one. But it's one that becomes important when we bring in the role of those who have the power to define what a landscape is going to look like and how it's going to operate. And then we think about those who then end up having to live in it. That distinction begins to make a difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, that's helpful. Yeah. Immigration reform, illegal aliens, these are topics that are being hotly debated in Washington, D.C., on the campaign trail these days. Whose interests are reflected in these debates?
Well, obviously, all of our interests are being reflected in the debates in one way or another. My current work, the first work that we've just been talking about, looked at California from 1913 to 1942. And the reasons for that is there was a big riot in 1913, which changed how California worked. But in 1942, a new program was developed called the Bracero Program, which is what I'll be talking about tonight. And the Bracero Program was a guest worker program that brought in, over the course of its existence, it lasted till 1964, hundreds of thousands of workers from Mexico under a controlled labor system, a contract labor system. It had all kinds of problems. It was rife with corruption. And now it's often looked back as an ideal labor time of controlled labor, of controlled immigration, and so forth. I don't think the historical record bears that out, but that's how it's often talked about. That program of guest labor eventually worked very, very well for growers. It worked well for growers because they knew that they could contract workers for a very short time and then send them back home. Right? So it became a very, very good policy for capital.
At a specific price, too.
At a specific price. They had to pay the prevailing wage, but there are big controversies over what the prevailing wage was, especially as braceros, as Mexican contract workers, came to dominate particular areas. Then it's hard to say what the non-bracero prevailing wage was because it didn't exist anymore. But it would be made up by some bureaucrats and in consultation with growers. So there would be So that kind of guest worker program worked very, very well, for the most part, for large growers in particular. Small growers were often opposed to it because it benefited large growers better. So that talk of guest worker programs has a history. It has a history of creating a labor supply and seeing immigrants primarily as labor. So when we start thinking about guest workers, we start thinking about immigration, we start thinking about illegal immigration. One of the questions we constantly have to ask is the one you asked, whose views are reflected. But we have to turn that a little bit and ask, who does it benefit? In the current system, illegal immigration largely benefits capital. It benefits capital in all kinds of ways, in part because undocumented workers are so thoroughly depowered quite often that they do not turn to the state, to agencies for problems in their labor code violations, labor law violations, and they are protected under labor law, whatever their status in most states. They won't seek recourse often because of the threat of deportation. It allows growers always to threaten INS raids, and we've been seeing that happening in the last 2 years quite frequently around unionizing campaigns, for example, where there are a lot of undocumented workers in a place, all of a sudden the INS shows up. And so there are these kinds of processes which benefit growers. The interest in the debates, of course, are much more complex than that. I mean, there is this real fear of the other, of people coming across the border, of losing control of this national space. It's not a fear that I necessarily think is a fully legitimate one, but it's there. And that kind of fear gets worked into it. But those debates are also reflected, as we saw in 2006, in the interests of immigrants, including undocumented immigrants who are here as well. So if you recall the large immigrant rights rallies of 2006, they were designed very thoroughly to try and transform the debates as to what it meant to be an immigrant in the United States, to transform the discourse in Washington and elsewhere. Of course, there was a huge backlash to that. But those interests began contending there over that. What's become interesting in this is the way in the last 2 or 3 months, questions of immigration and undocumented immigration in particular have seemed to have fallen off the current discourse in Washington. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see if they come back in the next 40 days, is it?
I just wanted to remind our listeners that you're listening to Focus 580. I'm Tom Bassett, professor of geography here at the University of Illinois. I'm sitting in for David Inge, who's away on vacation. Our guest this morning is Professor Don Mitchell from Syracuse University. He's going to be giving a public lecture this evening at 7 p.m. in Plym Auditorium in Buell Hall about his recent research on the Procera program, agribusiness, and the transformation of the California landscape during World War II. I invite you to call in if you have questions. The number to call is 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. In your book, The Lie of the Land, you write about the attempts of farmers and even state agencies to restrict freedom of expression, mobility, and assembly in public spaces. I know that you've also written a book recently on public spaces. Could you talk about this further?
Sure. In the California case, as workers started to get militant, they would often resort to public space, town squares in some of the agricultural towns in the areas, skid rows in the early part of the 20th century, to organize workers. Skid rows were incredibly important in California and throughout the American West for worker organization. It's where tramps, transient workers, hobos, met during the off-season or between jobs. And it was also where radical workers sought to organize their comrades. So they would take to the street corners, just as the Salvation Army did in the 19-teens, 1920s, to try and convince workers to join the union. And the case that I look at is the Industrial Workers of the World, a radical union that was quite powerful in California from around that time of 1913 to 1917. And they would use the streets, they would use parks, they would use town squares as rallying places, as speech-making places, as free speech zones. And the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, were very good at engaging in what they called free speech fights. City after city in the American West would pass laws banning free speech. And they would often talk about it in those ways. They would ban street oratory. They'd make exceptions for the Salvation Army or others who were doing proselytizing, as long as it was religious rather than economic proselytizing. And then they would arrest IWW members for speaking in public, for breaking public assembly laws, for tying up the traffic. They do all kinds of things. And so there are these famous free speech fights across the American West in the 19-teens primarily that the Industrial Workers of the World led. where they struggled for the right to be able to speak on the street. They would often climb up on a soapbox and start reading from the Declaration of Independence, for example, or from the Bill of Rights, and immediately be hauled off by a deputy sheriff or a city policeman and hauled off to jail. And then they would refuse to post bail, and another person would take their place. They'd get hauled off to jail. They'd fill the jails, and they would fill the jails and start costing the taxpayers a lot. And eventually, cities would give in and create new ordinances that made it possible to speak, perhaps, winning a right that all of us take for granted now. It's a very, very interesting history. But they often did this not just to win the right to speak on the streets, but precisely to organize. And they would, and it was often where there were big organizing campaigns, like in Fresno in 1912, when free speech fights would develop, and cities would try and shut that down on the behest of growers in the area, to break up organizing campaigns, to try and keep workers from joining what the IWW called one big union, and so. These fights often organized around labor. And so the streets themselves became incredibly contentious spaces. And that history continues. The streets were contentious in part because of things like the Alameda Plan, which made it harder to organize in labor camps where the workers were living. And so therefore, street organizing became all the more important, using public space where presumably we were supposed to have the right to speech and assembly anyway. So in the 1930s, again, during that big strike wave in 1933, 1934, streets in small towns across California, streets and parks, became central organizing locations, as did worker encampments. When they got kicked out of growers' camps, they'd create their own encampments, often on public space, sometimes on a sympathetic grower's property, but often on public space, where they argued they had the right to assemble. And the right to strike. Cities responded with restrictions on speaking in public. They responded with anti-picketing laws across California, an anti-picketing referendum in 1938, which sought to ban any more than two people at once marching up and down a street with a picket sign. That ended up losing. Anti-picketing ordinances like that were thrown out by the court in the 1940s. But nonetheless, that's how cities responded, to try and control that space, to make sure that labor organizing couldn't happen. So the streets become these sites of contestation, and they remain sites of contestation, which is my ongoing interest in them.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could switch the topic a little bit. I'm interested in your work at Syracuse University, where it's noted on the website that you direct the People's Geography Project. Could you tell us what that project is about?
Sure. The People's Geography Project has a couple of goals. One is to radicalize popular geography, and I suppose the other one is to popularize radical geography. And now I have to explain what I'm talking about. Most of us, when we hear the word geography, think National Geographic, perhaps, or we think maps, or we think maybe about the study of places, right? And all of that's important. All of that's a crucial part of geography. But geography is an incredibly, incredibly interesting field. And it's not just me as a partisan who's working in it saying that. It's an incredibly interesting field because we study everything. We study everything from global climate change to the kinds of things that I've just been talking about, the way that labor and landscapes come together in particular locations, to questions of ecology, and to peasant studies. I mean, you name it, we do it, right? And sometimes we do it well. And so it's a very, very exciting kind of field. And over the last 30 to 40 years in geography, the field has been amazingly transformed. It's been transformed as we've paid very, very close attention to theoretical and political developments in Marxism within the field and insights that can come from that, even though that's often a dirty word, especially in the United States. But in Marxism, within feminism, within various contemporary theories like post-colonialism, post-structuralism, and so forth, within anarchism, where, in fact, there's a long tradition in geography of anarchism. And these insights that have come from these political and theoretical movements have transformed how we think about spatial relationships, how we think about how people live in places, how we think about how space is organized, how we think about how the environment operates and under what conditions, and how nature is, right? All of these things have become crucial issues. But most of the world, and particularly the American populace, doesn't have any idea that these are the kinds of things that we do and that there's a political edge to it, to a lot of our work. Not all of it, but to a lot of it. And I think that political edge is important. I also think it's important just kind of in an evangelical way that that the more people can understand the insights that we've been developing in geography and that we've been learning ourselves in geography, the better off we'll be. The better off we'll be politically. The better off activists will be in organizing, because I think we have some insights for that. The better off debate will be over questions like, for example, climate change. And so what the People's Geography Project tries to do, although I'm not sure we've been overly successful at this, is transform those general debates about what geography is, what geography insights can be, and how a popular approach to geography can also be a political approach to geography. Our approaches have been through creating a lot of pamphlets. We did a number of pamphlets soon after September 11th about the geopolitics that were behind much of that. So we just didn't see it as something, a shot out of the blue, which it wasn't. We've done pamphlets around labor also, particularly the 1998 GM strike, which began in Flint and shut down GM across the Western Hemisphere, which is a very geographically interesting process. And so we done a number of pamphlets. We've sponsored a number of public events, conferences. I've used some of the money because it doesn't actually have any strings on it. It's not tied to the university or to any charitable organizations that have strings around them about the kinds of partisan work they can do. I've given money to political activist organizations that are working in particular ways to encourage, for example, the right to the city among those who are the least among us, those who have least access to housing and so forth. And so we've tried to develop those ideas. We've not done as much as we want because it's incredibly time-consuming. It's hard to write for popular audiences when we're trained into the academic way of thinking and talking. But also because after September 11th, we shifted a lot of our work toward the immediate needs of that moment and the kind of political backlash that was developing around that, particularly toward Muslims in the United States, for example, towards other peoples around the world and so forth. So we reorganized a lot of work. We haven't done as much as we'd like to, although other people have picked up the idea. And there are now people who are trying to develop people's geographies in Japan, in Italy, in Scandinavia. These are the ones that I'm aware of so far, to find ways of what would a popular geography in those places look like? How could we begin talking about a geography that people truly controlled, which is one of our key questions?
So you talk about work, but what specific activities? You talk about writing pamphlets.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you reach out to these constituencies and evangelical message here?
We've reached out in a lot of ways. Some of them, some of them minorly effective, some of them not effective at all. We supported the work of a guy at Eastern Carolina University named Derek Alderman, who put together a fabulous set of maps and brochures about streets named after Martin Luther King and where they are and what the politics of street naming are about. So people could start seeing about the racial politics behind street naming after Martin Luther King and the way that they're often contested in white neighborhoods if a Martin Luther King street is going through there, how they're welcome in black neighborhoods but not all black neighborhoods, and what those politics are about. And he put together a set of very, very accessible maps and brochures and mm-hmm. leaflets and so forth around this. We also supported the work of Laura Polito in Los Angeles, who's done a people's history map of Los Angeles that's now freely available on the web and so forth. And so these are ways that people can start seeing the landscapes that they live in new ways and what they might mean and learn some of the history of them, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So those are a few of the things that we've done along those lines. In Syracuse, we've gone in a different direction. And this was by, I just guessed because of the way things came together rather than by plan. And that is we've turned the People's Geography Project as much into what we call now a community geography project. And that started with some work we were doing on hunger in our city and trying to map where poverty was, where food insecurity was, and where the services that sought to address that were, how that changed between day and night because of when food pantries were open, so forth, and what that meant. And out of that came a whole series of discussions and debates and new policies governing, working on, looking at the ways in which we deal with hunger in our city. From that, we decided we want to create something called the community geographer, who's someone who's got good geographic information system skills, GIS skills, who can do really good mapping, who's got good community organizing skills, who knows how to work with very, very diverse communities. And her job is to work with all these communities to figure out new ways to understand ongoing problems in our city, like the ongoing deindustrialization of the city. like how did how neighborhoods are responding to the large influx of refugees, which are a big refugee receiving area now from around the world, actually. How to deal with hunger still, how to deal with things like teen pregnancies and STDs and new ways of thinking about that, and questions of racism in the city, which are ongoing. And it's a highly racially divided city. And so what our community geographer has done is worked with innumerable community organizations to try and show how thinking about these issues geographically, thinking about how space matters to them, how places matter, and how they know that they matter, and but providing a language for them to talk about it and new representations for them to see it with, right, has become very important. So I've been using some of the money I have with the People's Geography Project to support the Community Geography Project, and then I use a lot of my time to raise money to try and keep this going now. Mm-hmm. And so we've moved it in that way, which actually doesn't align with all of my politics for all kinds of reasons, but I think is an incredibly crucial way of dealing with this. And so we've moved it in a slightly different way that's very place-based for us right there in Syracuse, New York.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller from Champaign on line one. Go ahead, please.
My question is for WILL as much as it is for the guest, and he's touching on the area of my concern. You have a fairly frenetic speaker giving a lot of information all at once, and a lot of it is visual. If you wanted to tell me where the workers are in California, a map of graphic, it would be good. One local geographer here will show 200 slides in an hour. I'm wondering if WILL we'll get to the stage where it has a David Inge program and a Celeste Quinn program that is visual, that will be on video, and that might roll over onto the network. This has gone so fast that you can hardly have time to dream or ask your own question of the author, so you don't get so many call-ins.
Right.
So how do we do this in an era when visual material has become so helpful, and we can't put our – I run a radio program, and it's hard for me to put words around some of the landscape things that I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how WILL, with the encouragement of people like yourself, could do something to bring that rather expensive deal into the visual era.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good suggestion, a very valuable comment, and it's something, of course, I can just pass on to the program manager and the staff here and have them think about that. But you're right. It would be nice to wed the discussion with some visual materials that we could make these linkages, which can be pretty complex.
And all I can do is apologize, because when I get excited about what I'm talking about, I talk too fast. I understand that. I'll try and do better.
Great. Thank you. Let me just remind our listeners that you'll listen to Focus 580. I'm Tom Bassett, sitting in for David Inge, and our guest today is Professor Don Mitchell, visiting from Syracuse University. He'll be giving a public lecture this evening in Plymouth. With slides. In Buell Hall, Plymouth Auditorium. And the title of his talk will be Battle Fields, Bracero's Agribusiness and the Violent Transformation of the California Agricultural Landscape During World War II. Please, if you have questions, comments, feel free to call in. We have another call, this time from Urbana on line number two. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, and thanks for this really very interesting program, and I'm looking forward to the talk tonight. You've talked a lot so far about the way in which conflicts across classes are organized in terms of the landscape and geography, and many of the particularly in the book, The Lie of the Land, while many of the other projects you've talked about also address, I think, the organization of race and ethnicity in terms of landscape and space and place, and I'm sure that'll come up tonight, but I wondered if maybe you could talk a little bit more about those categories of social life in terms of the way that they're mapped onto landscapes and spaces and places, perhaps in agricultural California or other places.
Sure.
And I'll just listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. I will try to. And I will, just to make it as concrete as I can and hopefully provide a little bit of a word picture, give a couple of examples from California dealing with race in this instance. And that is, at the time that I looked at in The Lie of the Land, beginning in 1913, predominant members of the migratory class, at least in the northern part of the state, so the Central Valley and far north, and north from there, were white. And they were often Northern European. But there had been a long history of Chinese, Japanese, and there was about to be a history of Filipino and then increasingly Mexican workers in there. But at this particular moment, they were largely white. The majority, at least, were white. Transient males, for the most part. Although there was also a lot of family labor who would go and work in the harvest for part of the year. So there was that kind of racial makeup of the migratory class at the time. But there are real concerns about particularly Asian workers. This is a time of a huge anti-Asian backlash in the United States, and which California was at the forefront. And so there were exclusion acts in the 1870s. There were gentlemen agreements in the early 1900s that banned the movement of Japanese from Hawaii into California. But there are still large numbers of Japanese and Chinese workers. And in some of the records that I looked at, looking at all of this in California, there was this real concern about attracting white workers in a particular part, actually in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, and some of the fruit orchards there. And the problem was that the bunkhouses had been built in a way that was presumed to be appropriate to Japanese workers and to Chinese workers, and largely to male Japanese and Chinese workers. And until they transformed the actual bunkhouses themselves, they would never attract white workers, because whites, of course, deserved and demanded — I'll talk about this tonight, this is how it's always presented, it's not actually the case — deserved and demanded better conditions, more American conditions, than Asians did. And so the argument was, if you cut the bunkhouses in half, right, then you could make family housing out of them, and then whites would show up all of a sudden. Didn't matter what you paid, they would just show up. And so there's this incredible racist discourse that suggested that particular kinds of landscapes attracted particular kinds of people. It's exactly what they deserved. The landscapes represented perfectly what different racial groups deserved, what they naturally wanted, the way they naturally behaved. In the work that I'm doing now, you see time after time of growers saying that Mexicans don't know how to flush toilets. Why should we be required to have flush toilets? They don't want them anyway. If they have flush toilets, then they're going to not use them anyway. They'll just go and urinate out in the orchards or in the fields or behind the bunkhouses, right? This is completely wrong. And but this is how it was argued all the time. So there's this racist discourse that works through all of that, and the landscapes were built in response to this racist discourse, and then helped to reproduce it, to keep remaking that. And so by the end of the Bracero period in 1964, when Congress finally gets rid of it, their growers are saying, we'll never be able to attract non-Bracero workers, domestic workers, because we've built all our camps now that in ways that only Mexican contract workers will live in, and so forth. And so we can't do this. And so race works through it in that way. It works through space in all kinds of other ways, too, but it's important.
We have another call from Urbana on line 3. Please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This is a fascinating topic to me, and I look forward to reading your books. I have a question about the word agribusiness that's used in the title of your book. I'd like to hear you talk about what that word is and when it came about. When I was growing up, I always heard agriculture, and then at some point, I don't know, in the 60s or 70s, it suddenly became agribusiness. So I'm assuming that business consumed the culture part of it. So could you talk a little bit about when agribusiness came about as a word, as an idea, and as a practice? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks. I'll try to. I can only do this in reference to California, because that's the area that I know best. But growers in California — notice I've been using the term growers a lot rather than farmers, because that's how they styled themselves. Growers in California started talking about themselves as agribusinessmen as early as the 19-teens. The word began being used relatively generally in California in the 1920s and 1930s, because they really did style themselves something different than farmers in the East. Farmers on the other side of the Sierra. They saw themselves as creating a corporate form of agriculture, many of them. I mean, they're small farmers. It's a more complex story than that, but it's very important. Those on the left in the 1930s and 1940s actually more often talked about not about agribusiness and not actually about corporate farming, but talked about corporation farming and used that language. And the language of corporate farming, at least in the records that I'm looking at, doesn't start coming out in a big way until the 1950s and the 1960s. But agribusiness becomes a more general term that is used across the spectrum to talk about big corporate organized agriculture. I started seeing it in the records in the 19-teens, 1920s, and generally in print, in articles and so forth, by the 1940s, 1950s. And I think you're absolutely right that what disappears in one way or another is the culture.
I'm afraid our time is running out, and we have to end the discussion here. I'd like to remind our listeners that Don will be giving a public lecture this evening on his research on the Bracero program at 7 o'clock at Buell Hall. And, Don, I want to thank you for spending this very interesting hour with us, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks very much, Tom. This is great.